So there's a couple of things I'd like to know. I guess we had a little series of Bushra Umrah effect talks in Durham, and at the end of it, all the theorists were convinced that there wasn't a Bushra Umrah effect at all. So it's interesting to see that the new data and new analysis. That's okay for now. So the other thing I'd like to know is who bought embody.com, because it wasn't available. So I'll show some movies in this talk, and you can also download them from the webpage if you want to look at them again. So dynamical effects in clusters. What changes galaxy morphologies? We've heard a lot about mergers that can transform galaxies between types. In a cluster environment, mergers aren't expected to take place, and we have to look for other mechanisms if we want to transform galaxies between different morphological types. Now, the analytic theory was all worked out in the 70s and 80s by Rich Doan and Merritt, at least for the gravitational effects, and RZF and White and many others, and also the hydrodynamical effects that affect galaxies. The gas stripping processes were all published in the 70s and 80s by Gunn and Gott, and also Cowie and Sangalier and Nolson. The Gunn and Gott idea is the sort of bulk stripping of gas from disks, around pressure stripping, whereas the Nolson also examined the turbulent and viscous stripping of gas from spiral disks. So since the 70s and 80s, what's new? Well, we have this a nice model for the formation of structure in the universe, this hierarchical picture. And we also have 30 years of algorithmic development and computer speed-up, so we can now simulate these processes in detail. So I'll talk a lot about simulations of these processes. So basically, to summarize the hierarchical model, I'll just show a movie, usual sort of thing. I'll just kill that. Are we going to get some? There we go. I'm sorry if you've seen this before. It's just a dark matter simulation and follows. It's in physical coordinates, so you'll see the mass distribution just expanding as the simulation proceeds, and I'm just plotting the dark matter density. So this is this sort of resolution that we've achieved now using parallel computers and fast algorithms has solved one of the major problems in dissipationless n-body simulations, and that's we couldn't resolve substructure within dark matter halos. So at high redshift, all the mass is in lots of little tiny halos, and there's lots of you can see lots of mergers taking place between halos. You can actually follow these little white blobs are individual dark matter halos that are falling into deeper potentials, and you can actually follow their orbits and look at the dynamical look at the dynamics of these halos directly and compare with the analytic estimates first written down by Merritt and so on. So redshifts of 1 to 1/2, this is when all this activity is supposed to be taking place in clusters. Screensavers suck. So now the cluster, this particular cluster has assembled most of its mass by redshift of 1/2. So what's taking place over the next 5 billion years is just internal dynamical effects as these dark matter halos, which supposedly have galaxies at their centers, move through this environment. So they feel tidal effects, gravitational collisions, and they're also interacting with the gaseous medium in the cluster. You can actually trace the numbers of mergers that take place within this environment. And once the clusters are actually formed, then you don't actually see many mergers, apart from perhaps cold systems, small groups that are falling in at late times, and you can have mergers taking place in that environment. Blank that out for now. So you can take the final outputs of these simulations and do an analysis of the dark matter substructure that's left. And this is work that's been done by Sebastiano Guigner. And similar studies have been done by Anatoly Klipin, and I think Andrei Krasov might talk about that later in the afternoon. So just a couple of things I want to point out. What we learn now is that each of these circles here represents a dark matter halo within the n-body cluster that you extracted using some algorithm. And you see the basic effects that you expect from gravity is that the halos get smaller towards the center due to gravitational stripping. And you can compare with what you expect with the orbits given a simple gravitational stripping formula, and you can plot the expected tidal radius versus the measured tidal radius, and you get a nice correlation. You see the sizes of halos in the clusters are quite large. The dark matter that surrounds galaxies is still quite extensive, out to 50 kiloparsecs or so, depending on whereabouts you're orbiting in the cluster. We can now actually look at the orbits of these halos directly as well, plot those up and see what the galactic orbits expected to be doing. And you see here I'm plotting the pericentric divided by the apocentric distance against position in this cluster. The Vira radius is 2 megaparsecs here. And you see there's a wide range of orbits, but this is just very similar to an isotropic distribution, and which is actually quite radial. So you see about 20% of the orbits are on more radial orbits than 10 to 1. So they're really on quite plunging orbits, a lot of these galaxies, at least in this model. So actually should clarify that. If the dark matter, sorry to bring up collisional dark matter, but if the dark matter was a collisional fluid, then all of these quantities are actually very different. And like the orbits are different, the sizes of halos are different. But in fact, the observations cannot actually distinguish between these two extreme cases where the dark matter is collisionless and the dark matter is a fluid. Can't. They're very different. So the sizes of halos are much smaller in the fluid case, and the orbits are more circular in the fluid case, but currently the observations cannot probe those. Yeah. Good lensing, you could. So here's a cluster, I guess. We haven't seen that many pictures of clusters. So this is what motivated me to start looking at clusters, was the first HST images of the distant clusters at redshift of a half. Here's one from the Dressler sample at the top there, compared with a nearby cluster that's supposed to have the similar mass, the Coma cluster, of course, the typical cluster in the universe, but, well, not really. So what do you actually see? You see lots of interesting things. You see the high redshift clusters are full of disks, and the low redshift clusters are full of spheroidals, and we want to try and understand this evolution in the morphological content of clusters. So just to summarize some of the key questions that have already been talked about in the last few talks, what's driving this morphological evolution? And there's also a lot of the attention is focused on the bright galaxies in clusters. We must remember that most of the galaxies in clusters are actually dwarf galaxies, although they don't have most of the light. But at high redshift, most of the galaxies in those clusters are SC, SD, dwarf irregular types, whereas most of the galaxies in the Coma cluster are actually spheroidals, dwarf spheroidals, quite faint things. We want to know what the origin of the morphology-density relation is. And this mythical Butcher-Omer effect is really, it's split into three different effects now. There's the photometric effect, there's the morphological effect, and then there's a spectroscopic Butcher-Omer effect. So we search for mechanisms to explain those results. Low surface brightness spirals, we don't see them in clusters, but we see them in the field. Why is that? And what's the origin of this diffuse intracrustal light component? We're told from planetary nebula studies that perhaps there's a similar amount of starlight in a diffuse component in clusters that's attached to, that's just orbiting freely through the cluster potential. So I'll start with gravitational encounters and look at the effects of those. So we can now build equilibrium model galaxies that sort of resemble real galaxies in the universe, with dark matter halos, disks, bulge components. We can build them to resemble high surface brightness galaxies with flat rotation curves and bright luminous disks, or low surface brightness galaxies that may not have bulges and look something like this, maybe. And different galaxies respond differently to gravitational encounters. So here's a disk of that high surface brightness galaxy that sort of it was constructed to resemble the Milky Way galaxy. T equals 0.1, this is in billions of years. At T equals 0, another L-star galaxy flew past that at about 2,000 kilometers per second. You don't see any evidence for that encounter until a few hundred million years after the encounter took place, but you see the usual tidal tails are actually drawn out of this system. So doing exactly the same strength encounter to a low surface brightness galaxy, well, the effect is more visible because the disk is much bigger and the potential is shallower, so it's much easier to pull out bigger tidal tails. And this particular model has gone barren-stable through this single encounter. So again, just plotting the stars there in a 60 kiloparsec box about this. Well, there used to be this notion that low surface brightness galaxies are sitting in shallow potentials, but I guess that's being questioned now with the new data on rotation curves. The same circular velocity, the same luminosity of disk, but the central potential is different. Yeah. So instead of doing single encounters like that, you can actually take these model galaxies and Because we can't resolve galaxies forming in these cosmological simulations yet, it's still an open question. So we have to resort to building these model galaxies and putting them inside halos and watching their evolution so you can look at all the gravitational effects. So here's just a sequence of snapshots. It's the same cluster that formed in the previous movie. And the little green disk of stars here is actually a low surface brightness disk galaxy that I just put in a dark matter halo, replaced it with that system at redshift of 1, and let that fall into the cluster as it would have done if that halo had hosted a galaxy. And you see the green points here originally in the disk of the stars are all stripped out, and they sort of end up, by the final time, just tracing the orbital path through the cluster. So let me just show you another movie of that, because it's nice to see these things in a as they actually happen. So excellent. So what I'm showing here, this is exactly like the original sort of harassment movies that were made with Neil Katz and George Lake, apart from we're doing it in a cosmological context now because we have the high-resolution simulations that resolve the substructure and the evolution of the potentials. So what are these three panels? It's the same galaxy, and I'm plotting just the density of the stars in the disk of this galaxy. This is face-on, this is edge-on, and this is edge-on but viewed. The scale of this box is 2 megaparsecs. The scale of this box is about 50 kiloparsecs or so. So this galaxy just gets dropped into the cluster. You see the redshift ticking down there at the top. So it falls in a redshift of half, so it has a couple of strong encounters. It never merges with anything, but it has a very, you know, particularly strong encounter at that point, which pulls out these long streams of stars, and you know, there is no disk anymore just through that single strong encounter, and it has a few more. The encounters after the first one aren't as visible because you've changed this disk-like configuration into a spheroidal configuration. So yes, it has another encounter there, and more stuff is pulled out. So it's quite remarkable. No merging has taken place here, but you've gone from a cold, thin disk of stars into something that resembles a dwarf spheroidal galaxy. More than half the starlight has actually been stripped away from that disk and is now just upstreaming through the cluster, kind of tracing the orbital path. The galaxy. That was just an n-body galaxy with no gas. So you can do that with different model galaxies. Here I'm plotting the scale height of the disk of the galaxy versus time after you fell into the cluster. So the low surface brightness galaxy here that you saw in the movie, the scale height just it becomes a spherical sort of spheroidal system, and most of the starlights, you know, is stripped away. If you replace that halo, exactly the same halo on the same orbit with the Milky Way type model galaxy, which is more concentrated, then the disk remains pretty stable and only about 10% of the stars are lost, but the scale height of the disk is puffed up by a factor of 2 or 3 or so for this particular orbit. So low surface brightness galaxies, you can explain really why you don't see them in clusters. You can, this correlation function of LSB galaxies with CFA galaxies. Is this from Ho-Chun Mo? I can't remember where I got it from. So low surface brightness galaxies, if they're sitting in these shallow potentials, then you can explain why they get disrupted in clusters, and that's probably the mechanism for forming the diffuse starlight that we see in clusters. And you can never completely disrupt that galaxy. You'll always end up with a little bound pile of stars here, so that sort of resembles a dwarf spheroidal galaxy. These aren't dwarf elliptical galaxies. So these things have exponential surface brightness profiles and they're pressure supported, not like the high surface density dwarf elliptical galaxies we've heard about earlier. The LSB has a bigger disk. Well, there's no bulge, for example. No. Well, one's flat and one's rising.
The same way, you have the same flat as the dwarf, it's flat.
We'll talk about that later. It's different. We can do Dynamics 101 after the talk. So, well, we don't know what the rotation curves are actually are, so I'm. Yeah, well, the things get tightly truncated, so what you're left with is a shallow core. It was what I thought real galaxies looked like. I'll try and find it. Well, there isn't a dark matter left at the end because it's all stripped away in this. The tidal radius?
Yeah.
That you expect for the orbit in the cluster? It's about 30 kiloparsecs. But there's additional heating from halo-halo encounters. The disk scale length is bigger in the LSP. The disk scale length is extending further out. So just to put this on an observational plane, you're starting off with, here I'm plotting just B over sigma against the shape of the stellar component that's left. So you're starting off with, you know, highly flattened spinning disks, and what you end up with is galaxies that lie in this part of the plane that are really supported by internal pressure, not rotation anymore. And what limited data there are for these dwarf spheroidals in clusters seem to agree with the remnants that end up from the embodied simulations. So I guess one of the predictions from this model is that if dwarf spheroidals in clusters formed by this mechanism, then every one of them will be embedded in a very faint stream of diffuse stars that have been stripped away. And I guess observational evidence for that is very hard to find because the streams are very expected to be very faint. And you see a few spectacular examples of this, of galaxies in clusters. Examples as nice as this are quite rare. So you see these nice streams of stars that are being pulled out from this disk galaxy it's in the cluster. It's not merging with anything. It's just had an encounter somewhere in the cluster. This is from the Morse cluster, one of the Morse clusters. And you see some other spectacular examples, like the Centaurus arc. So here is the Centaurus cluster, and there's this very deep photographic image from Dave Malin reveals this spectacular stream of diffuse light here in the cluster. So you see some examples of this, but you really require much deeper images to detect the streams around the dwarf spheroidals. No, it's not lensing. It's actually it's too long a thin, and it's not in the right place to be an arc. So, what to sort of move on to the. We've heard that there seems to be something suppressing star formation in galaxies once they enter these extreme environments, and we see this in the CNOC data here. We've shown a version of this plot in the last talk, data from Mike Ballack. We see that, you know, galaxies seem to have some mechanism that suppress their star formation. Whether galaxy encounters and the harassment are enough to actually suppress star formation in big, bright L-star spirals, you heat up the disk by a factor of 3 or more, but whether that'll actually suppress star formation, I'm not exactly sure. So you're really searching for a mechanism that affects the gas content. And gravitational encounters aren't going to do that in Milky Way type spirals if they fall into these clusters. We're also searching for a mechanism that really transforms these spirals into S0s, as we've seen from Guinevere's talk and in the evolution of the spiral to S0 fractions in clusters. So turning to Gunn and Gott's work and Nilsson's work, these papers have been quoted many hundreds, if not thousands of times in the literature, but no one's actually investigated if the ideas were correct numerically, I guess because it's quite hard to do this realistically using 3D galaxy models at high resolution. So we did a first analysis of this using an SPH type code with Mario Abardi last year, and I'll talk also about some work that we've just finished with Vicent Quillis and Richard Bauer using a high resolution shock capturing code which captures more of the physics of the gas stripping processes. SPH doesn't really follow the turbulence and viscous stripping effects properly, so you can actually see that in using the Eulerian codes. So what do you actually expect from ram pressure stripping? Well, you can work out the restoring force on the gas disk acting from different components of the galaxy, depending on what sort of environment you're moving through. So each of these curves here is just the restoring force from the different component. And you see for a typical galaxy here falling, so rho equals 1 is the coma density, the core of gas, the gas density at the core of the coma cluster, and V is the velocity that the galaxy is moving through. So for example, I should use a pointer right here. Here's one. So this particular galaxy would have all of its gas stripped to about 3 kiloparsecs if it was moving at 3,000 kilometers per second through the coma cluster. And the disk the disk is doing most of the restoring force, but there's also a contribution from the bulge. So you can build a model galaxy and send a wind past it using the SPH code, and you see that ram pressure stripping occurs, and you get... So here I'm plotting the stripping radius versus time, and it's a very rapid process. It's just a few tens of millions of years. You go from a large extended gas disk to something that levels out. Each of these curves here is different orientations, different gas densities, and different velocities, and so on. But even the most extreme case, that galaxy moving at 3,000 kilometers per second through the core of the coma cluster, it has its disk stripped down to a few kiloparsecs, as we expected from the Gunn and Gott analytic argument. But you still got a significant amount of H1 gas left in that galaxy that's still going to form stars. And you don't strip out the molecular component as well. It's a fully self-gravitating model with stellar disk and gas particles. Why isn't it? Because the cooling time is very rapid, so there is a strong shock that goes through the disk, but it cools on a timescale that's 10 to 5 years. So we really want some mechanism that strips away all of the gas. So what about the effects that Nilsson talked about? Well, let's look at another movie. So we've taken the same model galaxy. So here, what I'm plotting here is an edge-on view through the gas disk. I'm plotting the density of gas in the disk. And the key point is we put about 10 holes in the center of this gas disk, so it kind of supposed to resemble observations, because galactic disks aren't completely smooth. They're filled with lots of little holes in the H1 component. And you see we happen to cut through one of those holes in this slice. So what do you see? This disk galaxy falls into this cluster. It's a coma gas density again at 2,000 kilometers per second. So you see immediately the outer edges of the gas disk is stripped away, and you see that the ICM starts to stream through these holes. You see lots of beautiful shock structures in the both the cluster gas and in the galaxy. You see these wisps of gas are being pulled out, and turbulence and all sorts of nice transport processes are taking place here. So the first thing you see is that very rapidly, on a few tens of millions of years, the outer gas disk is just stripped away through this bulk ram pressure process. But then on a slightly longer time scale, you see that you can't quite see at this resolution, but you see little wisps of gas being sucked out of the front of the disk here, and that's the turbulence stripping that Nilsson talked about. And this process evaporates gas from the disk, and it also, on a time scale of 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 years, it will remove all of the diffuse H1 components of this galaxy. So in 10 to the 8 years, there we go again, 10 to the 8 years is less than a crossing time across the core, so what we see in these simulations is that any disk galaxy falling through the core of a rich cluster will lose all of its H1 components through these processes.
The magnetic field that you have in the cluster would help.
help to? Yeah, we haven't included magnetic fields as usual.
But yeah. The exactly similar problem has been done in the medium with a trial of magnetic fields and put another wind blown by it. And the field helps it out.
Okay.
So when you say evaporate, do you mean with thermal conduction?
No, through turbulence and viscous stripping.
Why do you call it evaporating?
I shouldn't have called it evaporating. So in 10 to the 8 years, all of the 100% of the diffuse gas is stripped. Okay. 10 to the 8. Well, I would say that there shouldn't be any. You should not see a spiral galaxy in the coma cluster if it's been through the anywhere near the core. And I think that's true. You see, if you look at the H1 images of Van Gorkum, then out of all the galaxies that they surveyed with 21 centimeter in coma, I think they only found 9 positive detections of H1 flux from any galaxy. And those spirals were heavily stripped, so they may be in falling for the first time. Sorry? Of the ICM? It's taken from the mass observations of the central 300 kiloparsecs of the coma cluster. I can't remember the exact number in my head. Yes. So you saw the time there is in millions of years. Well, that's a really interesting question because, of course, these processes don't affect the molecular gas at all because they're just like point sources. They're so dense. But what happens is molecular clouds recycle on a rapid time scale. And they regenerate from the diffuse component that's there. So once you've stripped away the diffuse component, those clouds should evaporate on a 10 to the 7 year timescale, and then that gas would subsequently be removed. So there's actually no reservoir for forming stars in these galaxies. And I actually searched for references for molecular gas content of these S0s, because that's what's really happening. You're taking a disk galaxy here and removing all of the star-forming material, and it should end up looking like an S0. And there were no positive detections of CO in any S0 galaxies in the coma cluster. So I think that could be evidence for this process. Sure, but those are classified as spirals, so they haven't actually had all of their H1 removed, so you see CO still in those galaxies. Once the H1's been stripped and the CO's vanished, then those galaxies, you may need some extra disk heating from the harassment process to actually remove any residual spiral features, but those galaxies should be completely transformed into S0s from these processes. So, and these effects don't really depend on the inclination too much. We've simulated pretty edge-on orbits here. The disk galaxy is falling in, inclined about 15 degrees to the cluster direction. And the same effect happens. It's actually just as effective for this viscous stripping processes. So you can't get around this stripping process from things falling in inclined. So, I guess I'll just summarize. There's some kind of future direction. So we see a lot of observed morphological evolution in galaxy clusters. Look, bright spirals disappearing, perhaps transforming into S0s. We see these small disk galaxies, SC to dwarf irregulars, that maybe have been transformed through tidal heating into dwarf spheroidal galaxies. Perhaps LSBs are being completely ripped apart and forming the diffuse light component. And of course, these effects are all more stronger at the center of the cluster where galaxy interactions are more frequent and the gas density is higher. So I think that it should lead to a natural explanation for the morphology-density relation. And these processes can all be, you know, described by the physical mechanisms I've talked about. So I think we've got enough mechanisms now to explain almost anything you want. It's just a question of putting in all those pieces together to make a big picture. So, I mean, what we really want to do is resolve galaxies forming in these simulations and just look at the, observe the, these processes directly. But we can't do that yet. So it looks like the best way of doing this is a combination of these high-resolution simulations with semi-analytic models, which can say what sort of galaxy should be in a given halo given that galaxy's merger history. And then we can follow that halo through the cluster and impose these dynamical effects directly and see if we can recover the redshift devolution that is observed for these effects. So I'll stop there. Thank you.